Welcome to the Social Network Show. How do you feel about social technology in this connected, networked world we live in? Your host of the Social Network Show, Dr. J, interviews entertaining and informative guests to tackle the most pressing digital issues of interest to business professionals and nonprofit leaders, to parents and educators, and to those wondering where all this is taking us. And now your host, experimental psychologist, Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Tragic events in Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, Maryland, and way too many other places across the country have many people wondering about the state of law enforcement and its ability to work effectively in their communities. Today we are going to tackle the issue of community policing efforts and how those events have taken a toll on police-community relations. Welcome to the Social Network Show and the National Crime Prevention Council series. I'm your host, Jane Karwoski, experimental psychologist, Dr. J, and host of Social Network Show. My co-host today is Michelle Boykin, Senior Director of Communications of the Washington, D.C. nonprofit National Crime Prevention Council. Michelle, you always bring us the most knowledgeable guests. Who do you have joining us today?
Well, Dr. J, today joining us is someone that I recently met, Sue Rahr, and I met her during a business trip to Washington, D.C., where she was here in town, and she is the executive director of the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission, and she's a former King County Sheriff of Seattle, Washington, where she was the first female to hold that impressive position. She was appointed to the position in 2005 and then elected in 2009. She came up through the ranks from a patrol officer to supervising a patrol unit and other areas from burglary, larceny, criminal warrants, and special assault units. She also served as the commander of the internal investigations and gang units and the special investigations section. Ms. Rahr has spent 33 years of her life in law enforcement or criminal justice. Currently, she's a prominent fellow for the Police Foundation, where she co-authored a New Perspectives in Policing document that we're excited to talk with her about today. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Thanks for having me. Well, Sue, I am fascinated by the fact that you were the first female sheriff in King County, especially as a former Seattleite myself. What was one of your memorable experiences serving as the head of a sheriff's department?
Well, I have to say there was many memorable experiences. One that touched me and continues to stay with me was basically reaching out to a family of a 12-year-old boy who was killed in a drive-by shooting by a gang member. It was a matter of mistaken identity. And this 12-year-old boy was an incredible person. He came from a wonderful family that happened to live in a neighborhood that was plagued by gang violence. And it was a very painful and also rewarding experience to get to know his family and understand some of the difficulties they were having living in the neighborhood and then trying to come to grips with his loss.
That would have been very impactful for your future experience, I'm sure. Did your experience in law enforcement in general prepare you for the career you have now?
I think so. I had the opportunity. I had 3 decades to learn from a lot of my own mistakes and learn from some of my successes because a lot of my career was spent in a position of being a supervisor or a leader. I also had the opportunity to learn from other people's failures and successes. So lots and lots of exposure to good police work and bad police work. And it's all been very educational.
Mm-hmm. Lots of observation. And you must have been very thoughtful and reflective during that time to gain so much from it. You and a colleague wrote a report about recommitting American police culture to democratic ideals. I love that title. Can you give our listeners a short summary of the report? I know that on the website it said it was to combat the culture and mindset that law enforcement officers are warriors at war with the people they are sworn to protect, instead of viewing it themselves as a part of the community. So can you just give us a brief rundown on what your main points were in that article?
Yeah, there's really two main focuses. First of all, I really want for law enforcement professionals to regain their focus on democratic ideals rather than political expedience. And I think we've watched that as a nation, the idea of, you know, tough on crime, the war on crime, zero tolerance, has had some unintended consequences. And so I want to reestablish the focus on democracy and the appropriate role of policing in a democracy. The other important point of the paper was to talk about the culture within police departments themselves and how the culture inside the police department will be reflected on the street. Officers mm-hmm. learn inside their agencies how power should be used. If the agency has a healthy culture where power is used appropriately and procedural justice principles are followed, then you can expect that kind of behavior to be demonstrated on the streets by the officers.
Well, that is very thought-provoking. There's a lot in those few sentences. You stated in the report that law enforcement has sort of drifted off course in building close ties to the community. What do you think happened to change that?
Well, I think it started out, frankly, as this whole political movement back in the 60s, where it became very politically popular to develop a tough-on-crime stance. And I think that that has led to police departments, which are a reflection of their local government, to over-focus on crime control to the exclusion of other important social factors. I'll give you a practical example or an analogy. When a body has cancer, you try to destroy that cancer with chemotherapy. But if you're overly aggressive, you end up destroying the immune system. And I think mm-hmm. some of our crime strategies that only focus on arrest and incarceration has the effect of destroying that immune system of the community, which we would call collective efficacy. And that is the ability of the community to manage itself.
I'd like to get into that a little deeper, and we'll take a break now and talk more with Executive Director Sue Rahr of the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission in the second half of our show today. I'm Jane Karwoski, and you're listening to The Social Network Show.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Every day, people are afraid to report violent crimes. In times like these, choosing to report a crime or helping the police can be a difficult decision. A no-snitching culture has sprung up in our communities, making it unpopular and sometimes even dangerous to report a crime. Do the right thing by calling 911 or your local crime tip line. If you're the victim of a crime, report it. If you know about a crime, report it. To learn more about how to do the right thing, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show and the National Crime Prevention Council series of interviews with my co-host, Michelle Boykins. We are speaking with our guest, Sue Rahr, as Executive Director of the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission. Now, Sue, you were just explaining collective advocacy as a concept. Please continue with that.
Yes, it's actually collective efficacy, and that refers to the ability of a community to properly maintain social control and order. And the things that make up the factors that make that up are things like school, jobs, families, community ties. If we overuse arrest and incarceration, that takes juveniles out of school, it takes parents out of jobs, it breaks up families, it breaks up the community ties. Now, absolutely, there are times when we must use arrest and incarceration because a person is too dangerous to be in the community. But when mm-hmm. we overuse arrest, if that is the only tool we use to maintain peace, we end up damaging that system of school attendance and family. And those are the strongest ways our communities maintain peace and order.
Those are deep thoughts. I say that because, to me, I agree. I think it makes great sense. I'm just wondering the forces that work against that can seem overwhelming. And it's almost like theory X and theory Y of supervision. You know, you assume that these people that you're policing are for the worst and need to be dealt with harshly, et cetera, versus they will do their best and you can facilitate
well, I
that
think I,
and encourage it.
Yeah, I think what we need to do is consider, you know, the idea of a zero tolerance policy makes no allowance for the degree of danger of a particular crime. I'll give you a specific example that we often hear about, and that is suspending students from school when they misbehave. Now, when you if a student is acting out, there's one school of thought that says harsh punishment is the best way to get them to stop acting out. On the other hand, the reason that a 13-year-old might be acting out is there's something going on that's causing that behavior. If we kick them out of school, we have now broken an important social system that helps channel their behavior in a beneficial way. So before we kick them out, we better make sure that I think we should look at other alternatives to address the misbehavior. That you can take that example and compound it into adults in the community. Find out what is it that's causing the person to commit crimes. The goal is to get them to stop committing crimes. And jail is certainly one method to do that, but we need to make better use of some of the other methods, I think.
Right, that's very, very, I agree with you. Michelle,
I was going to say, Dr. J, you know, based on that, you know, that there are other methods out there. What do you think, Sue, that law enforcement can do to build a rapport with the public, to work on, you know, some active community policing and, you know, and deal with those situations where they may have kind of an embattled relationship with the public?
Well, I know once that relationship with the community is very badly damaged, it's hard to reestablish that rapport. But it's absolutely critical, and I think one effective way is for law enforcement leaders in particular to create opportunities for the police to interact with the community in a non-enforcement function. That was one of the recommendations of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. And so that might look like having an officer work at a community center as a coach or work as a school resource officer in a school to build a relationship with the teachers, with the kids, and with the parents. And as you develop those opportunities to interact, the relationship will begin to grow.
And so do you think that the future of policing, does it give you hope or does it give you heartburn about getting more police departments to embrace that community policing strategy to develop those closer ties to the community?
I think right now I have a great deal of hope. We are having a national conversation, I think, about the culture of policing and the role of police in our society. I think my new recruits coming in the door, I train about 500 new officers per year, and they are very optimistic. My observation of, you know, Gen Y, if you want to call it that, is they have very good hearts and they're very interested in what's good for the greater group. And I think we have a very bright future.
And do you think that working with those recruits that they're really going to be the kind of seed change that you need within a department? Because, you know, you have the folks who've been there for a while and, you know, maybe have risen up the ranks. How do you balance the new recruits and the hope that they bring with those who've kind of, you know, been there traditionally in law enforcement for many years?
Well, I think what we can do with the new recruits coming in the door is we can provide a deeper education so they have the ability to develop empathy for the people that they're interacting with. And if they have a better understanding of what that person is dealing with, they're going to be more successful. I think a lot of veteran cops that have been on for 20, 25 years, they have learned to be empathetic over time because they have gotten to know people. My goal is that our brand new recruits will go out on the street having the wisdom that would otherwise take a veteran 20 years to acquire.
And how, just so I understand that, you're counting on their generational culture to do that?
Well, that's what I find is my younger recruits seem to be very open-minded, and they come from a broader background of experience. We have everything from former prosecutors to social workers, teachers. It's a very broad base of experience I see coming in the door.
Interesting. What do you think, can you think of anything particular that accounts for that in terms of why a different type of person is being attracted to law enforcement now than in years past?
Well, I think, you know, I can just addressing gender, I think we have more female role models in law enforcement, and people go into professions where they see that they might fit. And as the ranks of police officers become more diverse, I think that just continues to build momentum and provides role models for people who might not have thought of law enforcement as an alternative before.
And with the younger recruits that you're seeing come in, do you also think that maybe technology is going to play a role in helping them engage the public?
Absolutely, and I find it humorous sometimes when my fellow baby boomers, we are not technology natives, so to speak, and it took me a while to appreciate the fact that many people in the younger generation are very connected via social, you know, technology to social networks in a way that I never was. And so even though I may not see them conversing, they are connected to their friends and their social groups all the time. So, you know, the traditional way of looking at communication, it looks like they're not communicating, but in fact, they're communicating far more. And I think that it creates opportunities for things like a virtual block watch, where you would have entire neighborhoods on the same Twitter feed, and you can very quickly get important information out to huge numbers of people in a way that we never could in the past.
And it's encouraging to see that beneficial aspect of technology and the connections that it promotes. I want to tell our listeners about the link to your report, and it is called From Warriors to Guardians, Recommitting American Police Culture to Democratic Ideals. And you can find it at nij.gov, and just put in the search bar Warriors to Guardians. Or if you want more background, executive session policing for the search term. But Warriors to Guardians, I downloaded it and looked over. I just think it's very, very inspiring because it does come from actual experience. Because if I understand it right, this is a change in the training of the Washington State Police Academy. Is that correct, Sue?
Yes, we started changing our strategy and our philosophy about 2.5 years ago. And so we've got a couple of years' experience under our belt, and the outcomes are very promising. We also have a study underway being conducted by researchers from Seattle University. And if we can maintain funding, we hope to create a 5 to 10 year longitudinal study to see what kind of impact this new training philosophy has as officers go throughout their career.
Now, there are different ideas out there, sometimes referred to as conspiracy theories, that there's a movement afoot to militarize the police for the sake of gaining control over the citizenry. And I just, one thing that occurred to me as I was reading your report and thinking about our conversation today is that the states, not the federal government, the states are actually in charge of how they train their police forces. Have I got that right? I mean,
Yes.
Is it city? How many police academies and state troopers and so forth, how many academies are there in each state?
It's different in every state. There's about 650 police academies across the United States, and every state has a different system for how their officers get trained. I was just testifying last week in front of Congress, and one of my points to the Committee on the Judiciary was there is no single culture in policing. There is no single method for training police and no single method for operating a police department. We have 18,000 different police departments, and they are overseen and managed by 18,000 local governments. And they all do it their own way. Law enforcement is very much a local service controlled by local government. There's actually fairly minimal influence the federal government has over local policing, frankly.
Well, I think that can put minds to rest who feel there maybe is some overarching negative thing going on. It's also encouraging to see how you've been able to affect for the positive this kind of cultural thing. And in reading the report, you mentioned that even the physical surroundings, the design or the decor, what is visual in the academy has changed. What happened there? What did you do?
Well, what I found when I arrived at the academy is all of the symbols and, you know, accoutrements of culture were all focused on war and survival and battles. It was a very, very, very much a warrior-type mentality, and with very little talking about service and protection. So what we did is we changed out a lot of the visual cues, and instead of having a trophy case with all of the weapons and accoutrements of warfare, we have a huge wall-size mural of the Constitution. And we spend a great deal of time in the training talking about the Constitution. During the first week of training, each recruit is given a copy of the Constitution. Mm. And I tell them, in my training over, you know, 3 decades, all of my training about the Constitution focused on working around it so that I could make an arrest. And unfortunately, I think that's a common experience. And my goal in our academy is to explain to the recruits the Constitution, protecting the Constitution is your mission. And don't look at it as an impediment. Look at it with pride. And you have the privilege of defending our sacred constitutional rights. And it's actually been very effective because many of our recruits are military veterans. And they have friends that lost their lives defending the Constitution. And I tell them, you dishonor their sacrifice if you violate people's civil rights. And that has a powerful impact on the recruit.
Mm-hmm. That is, well, it's a powerful argument. And the fear-inspiring aspect that you have mentioned also in your article about the focus in the old school method was on staying alive, that there were lots of horror stories about police officers who lost their life in the line of duty and so forth. And I have wondered in the idea of so many shootings by police officers, if there isn't a lot of, you know, protect yourself first and deal with the situation secondarily. Do you think that that's a factor?
Well, I think that is the greatest challenge for any police officer, to balance your personal safety against the rights of others. And every police officer has to draw that line personally. And, you know, what we try to do is provide them the absolute best training. We actually have increased the amount of firearms and defensive tactics training. So officers have absolutely the best skills they possibly can have, and they practice a lot so that those skills become second nature. And when they end up in a violent confrontation, this is where the neuroscience training comes in, the front part, the decision-making part of their brain is available to assess the situation and make a good decision rather than being taken up by, you know, what are the physical things I have to do with my firearm? So we train those skills relentlessly so that their brain power isn't being used up trying to figure out how to draw and point a weapon.
Well, how about how to not draw the weapon? When you say defensive tactics, are you talking about non-firearm
tactic?
It includes a lot of things. Most of the defensive tactics are physical skills, you know, how to control someone's hands, how to get them, how to disarm somebody, those kinds of things.
Right.
But we also infuse that with communication skills and de-escalation. But I want to go back to the important decision an officer has to make is, how can I simultaneously keep myself safe and the person I'm having a confrontation with safe? And it's very, very difficult, and it's very complex. But the better the officer's skills and decision-making abilities are, the better the outcome for the situation.
And it seems like, Sue, it's also about how do I also protect the rest of the community that's around me in that situation as well.
Exactly.
Isn't that part of the scenario?
That's a huge part of it. When an officer draws their firearm, they have to be thinking about what else might be hit. If I fire my weapon, what's the backdrop? But there is also the reality of the physiology that happens in a threatening situation.
Mm-hmm.
And officers, just because they're human beings, they develop tunnel vision, and sometimes they don't physiologically have the ability to see beyond that threat right in front of them. And so that's what we work on in training, is how to manage your own stress so that you've got your entire brain helping you make a decision and make an assessment of what's happening in front of you. So yes, there's certainly a moral factor involved, but there's a lot of physiology and neuroscience that comes into play as well. And we have to be realistic about what we expect our police officers to be able to do.
Absolutely.
When their life is being threatened.
Mm-hmm. What about when someone's running away from them? Mm-hmm. Is there ever an excuse for shooting someone in the back if they're running away?
I would say it depends. It depends on what that person has just done and what you think they are about to do. So if somebody has done something that doesn't create a risk and they're running away, I find it hard to believe that there's a reason to shoot them. However, if somebody has just randomly shot a whole bunch of people and they still have a gun, and there's a good likelihood that they're going to shoot more people, then yes, it would be the appropriate thing to shoot them as they're running away. So there is no single answer for running away, because there's so many other factors that have to be considered.
Right, depending upon the degree of risk they pose. Okay, well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today, Sue.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And thanks, Michelle. Appreciate your wonderful guest.
Thank you so much, Dr. J. This was really exciting and interesting.
And that is Michelle Boykins of the Washington, D.C. nonprofit National Crime Prevention Council. And thank you all for listening. Please mention to your social networks online and off that you enjoyed the show. If you're listening via iTunes, please subscribe to this podcast and do check out our website, thesocialnetworkshow.com. Until next time, please be safe and have fun online and off.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.